It's 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. Ago today, Americans turned on their televisions late in the evening to hear then-President George Bush make a serious announcement.
My fellow citizens, at this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq, to free its people, and to defend the world from grave danger. On my orders, coalition forces have begun striking selected targets of military importance to undermine Saddam Hussein's ability to wage war. These are opening stages of what will be a broad and concerted campaign.
Bush went on to say he entered the war reluctantly, but that Iraq threatened the peace with weapons of mass murder. Soon into the conflict, however, it became clear those weapons didn't exist, but the war itself dragged on. After Saddam was toppled, long-suppressed ethnic tensions in Iraq erupted, and American forces found themselves caught in the middle. Finally, after 8 years, the U.S. military pulled out, with the last combat forces leaving at the end of 2011. Some were soon redeployed to Afghanistan. Others, though, came home to start new lives and new careers. And that includes our guest this hour. Today in The Exchange, a roundtable of New Hampshire veterans, including those who served in Iraq, joins us to look back 10 years since that war began. We'll hear their stories, get their thoughts on this war, and let's hear from you. Do you have personal experience either serving in Iraq yourself or with a family member who did? What's going through your mind a decade later after this war began? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. We have three guests for the hour. Joining me in studio is Oliver Spencer, former Marine who served in Somalia, Afghanistan, and Iraq. He had several deployments in Iraq from 2004 to 2008. And Oliver, it's good to have you. Thank you for being here.
It's good to be here. Thank you.
Joining us by phone is Jacob Worrell. He was raised in Nashua, New Hampshire. Today, he's Product Strategy Coordinator for the Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. Jacob was a sergeant in the Army between 03 and 07. He served in Iraq from 05 to 06. And Jacob Worrell, great to have you too. Thanks for being with us this hour.
My pleasure.
Also joining us is Al Porcia, a Vietnam veteran who worked until just recently as a readjustment counseling therapist at the Manchester Veterans Center, working a lot with veterans from the Iraq War. And Al Porcia, welcome back. Good to have you too.
Good morning, Laura. Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, we played that little bit of sound from George Bush's speech. Of course, many of us remember that night. Oliver, where were you? What went through your mind as you heard him speak as a member of the armed forces?
I was the executive officer, which is second in charge of a force reconnaissance company out of Camp Lejeune, and they were deployed. I stayed behind as a remain behind element commander to send other platoons and other forces forward at the time. So I was at Camp Lejeune, unfortunately, listening to it all while my unit was forward deployed.
Yeah, so you're listening and you're thinking, okay, sooner or later it's probably going to be my turn.
Correct. And the thing about it that was so difficult was the whole lead up to it. At that point, we really I was an intelligence officer, and the intel didn't match up that we were going to do this. We thought we were going to sort of do some saber rattling in Kuwait, but I never really thought we were going to cross into Iraq. So when it actually happened, it didn't seem it was very surreal that we were actually crossing the line. Because
wow.
I had done a lot of war games prior to that to study that and understand the intelligence, particularly the part of the W's weapons of mass destruction. So it was our own shock and awe in the intelligence community that we were actually going forth with this operation.
What do you remember, Jacob? What were your feelings as you watched the president make that speech?
Well, I mean, to be honest, I don't remember actually watching it. At the time, I was a naive 19-year-old kid, still kind of processing the events of 9/11 and figuring out what I wanted to do to serve my country. I ended up enlisting after the Iraq War. I thought that it was my patriotic duty, and I wanted to be able to serve in whatever capacity I could. So just a few months later, I ended up enlisting in August, I think, after. And But I, you know, as in terms of like actually watching that press conference, I don't even know if I did. I was probably doing something that 19-year-olds do at the time.
Although a pretty quick turnaround there. I mean, the war started in '03, March of '03. You jumped in August, so pretty quickly you made up your mind, Jacob.
Yeah, and I think after, you know, once it was announced that we were going to war with Iraq, I, you know, that basically just pushed me to go to the recruiting station and say, you know, this is what I wanted to do. I was kind of already considering it before that, but for whatever reason, that is just what pushed me to actually take that step.
And Al Porcia, as we said, you're a Vietnam veteran, but we've invited you this hour because you worked a lot as a readjustment counseling therapist at the Manchester Veterans Center. So there you are. What was your own reaction, both personally as a veteran, but also as someone who works with veterans, Al?
Right. Well, it was, of course, of concern to see that once again we were going to be dealing with our men and women going off for armed conflict, because I'd been working for some time already at the Vet Center dealing with Vietnam veterans, World War II Korean veterans, and there was little doubt in my mind that it would only be a matter of time till we began to see people returning from the Iraq and Afghanistan wars because the kinds of emotional trauma that soldiers experience seems to be universal to all wars.
Yeah, so as a Vietnam veteran, you're injecting that personal element into it.
Absolutely.
You know, to you, Oliver and Jacob, since you guys were actually there, Oliver, remind us when you served in Iraq and why the timing of one's service is significant. Because, as I remember, this war went through a lot of phases, you know, where things seemed to be going better and worse and better and worse and so forth.
Yeah, well, I think it came down to a total of six phases. And I know that's how they do the campaign medals for if you served in Iraq. But the initial part was, of course, the assault. You're on the ground, and that is just a very kinetic, very high-paced environment, a lot of uncertainty. And then I got there in 2004 was my first tour there. I was actually in Afghanistan working on a special operations task force, essentially going after bin Laden. We were literally looking for him. But Abu Mukab Musabi, and I'm saying his name incorrectly, but he had just – al-Qaeda in Iraq had really erupted. So I was shifted over to Iraq to go look at that.
Because of your experience, yeah.
Correct. And it really was – that's when we really sort of had an eye-opening experience that the Iraqis are not going to just lie down, and it's not going to be this great liberation that we thought. And they had seen the telltale signs of it prior to that. But that was my first exposure. I was north of Baghdad. I was moving pretty much in the Sunni triangle, and we were looking at for high-value targets. And most of the stuff was al-Qaeda-type targets that we were looking at.
So the timing, Oliver, is significant because, again, it went through phases. The Sunni awakening.
Right. I was there for that, too. That was in 2006,
Fallujah,
2007.
Abu Ghraib, all these.
Right. It is very important because we obviously had different missions during that time. Initially, it was this great liberation, and then we switched over to this nation building. But prior to shifting over nation building, we really had to focus on suppressing al-Qaeda in Iraq. And much of the intelligence assessment was incorrect. And it just took time to really gain the intel on the ground, as we said. I was in Al-Anbar province. I was working out of Fallujah at the time when the Al-Anbar awakening. And actually, my boss at the time was the one who wrote the critical assessment that was published in 2006, about August. It was a classified assessment that was leaked to the Washington Post that said Iraq or Al-Anbar province, al-Qaeda is very prevalent in Iraq at the time. And if we don't make some serious changes, we are going
to
lose this whole thing.
That's what
and it really
kind
of turned
right?
it. And General Casey, as well as a lot of the other commanders, saw this. And that's where we just started to see that we were a lot of these Iraqi sheikhs who really weren't affiliated with Iraq or with al-Qaeda were not siding with al-Qaeda. Because al-Qaeda had overstepped their bounds.
Well, and Jacob, to you too. Again, as I said earlier, you served in Iraq from 05 to 06. Every tour of duty in Iraq had a different tone to it, sometimes even a different mission, as Oliver has said. What about you, Jacob? What was significant about the time that you were there?
Well, I served between 05 and 06 in Mosul for the first 12 months, and then we were actually extended at the tail end of the tour to go down to Baghdad. And I don't know what the official military history calls the phase I was in, but I would guess I would call it the pre-surge phase, because towards the tail end of my tour, Baghdad was falling apart, and we were sent down there to sort of boost the forces in that area of operations to make sure that the city didn't completely deteriorate until the troop bolster that came in, that I guess they called the surge with the capital S. So we were kind of the pre-surge forces just to make sure that Baghdad didn't completely fall apart. And that's my tour ended up being 16 months. It was my only tour, but it was a long one.
Yeah, that is long. And it was extended. We read a lot about that during the Iraq War, didn't we, Jacob, that people thought they were going home and then they'd get a message saying, you know, oh, by the way, you're not going home.
Yeah, and in my unit, in fact, people were sent home, and they stayed a week with their families, and then they were told they were coming back.
A week? Wow.
It got a lot of press, so I heard. We were the Fort Wainwright, Alaska unit that were, you know, I think one-third of our infantry units were sent home, and then we're told, surprise, you're coming back to Baghdad.
Well, Jacob, I know you have to go in less than a minute, but if I could just ask you real quickly, 10th anniversary, here we are, lots of reflection going on around the country. What are you reflecting on this day, a decade later?
You know, the war is over, but its impact extends past what happened in Iraq and, you know, the dollars spent and the lives lost. I want people to know that for the veterans who served there, a lot of the veterans, the struggle is not over. The tragic fact is that 22 veterans commit suicide today on average, and that's something the American people need to know. I'm down here with Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, and we're in Washington, D.C. this week. We brought about, you know, 30 vets down to the Capitol, and they're here to tell their stories to congressmen and senators and congressional offices and even the White House.
Okay, Jacob, I got to let you go, but he's part of that big move again to raise veterans' issues on Capitol Hill. Thank you for being with us. We'll take your calls after a break.
Good morning. It's 9:19 and more with New Hampshire veterans on the Iraq War. It's 10th anniversary coming up on The Exchange. At 10 on The Diane Rehm Show, President Obama's trip to the Middle East. We have a winter storm warning in effect for all of New Hampshire till midnight tonight. Today, snow mixing with some sleet this afternoon in southern and southeastern sections of the state. Accumulations 4 to 8 inches, highs 30 to 35. Then tonight, mostly cloudy with snow coming to an end. Total accumulations from 8 to 14 inches possible, lows 20 to 25 degrees. Support for NHPR comes from UR members, and support also comes to us from Franklin Pierce University, a leader in adult education offering an RN to BS in nursing. New term begins in April. Information at franklinpierce.edu. And Country Woods Furniture, dedicating March to helping you get organized. Organizational tips, hints, and products at their location on Route 27 in Raymond and countrywoodsnh.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, Granite State veterans of the Iraq War reflect on this conflict 10 years later. We invite you to join us at 1-800-892-6477. Send a short email to exchange@nhpr.org or post a comment on our Facebook page. If you have personal experience, either serving in Iraq yourself or you had a family member who did, what sorts of thoughts are going through your mind a decade after this war began? The number here in The Exchange is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Our guests with us, Oliver Spencer, former Marine who served in Somalia, Afghanistan, and Iraq, serving in Iraq several deployments from 04 to 08. And Al Porsche is with us, a Vietnam veteran who has worked a lot as a readjustment counseling therapist at the Manchester Veterans Center, working with Iraq and Afghanistan vets. We heard earlier from Jacob Worrell, raised in Nashua and served in Iraq between 05 and 06. Again, your phone calls are welcome, 1-800-892-6477. And gentlemen, let's go to our callers now. And Jacob is on the air from Bristol. Hi, Jacob. Excuse me, Joshua. I apologize. Go ahead, Joshua.
Yeah, I just had a question for your two panelists.
Sure.
Regarding Vietnam and Iraq. I served with 1st Battalion, 2nd Marines, and 2nd Battalion, 6th Marines in Fallujah. The parallels between the Gulf of Tonkin and everything that transpired with Vietnam, the lives lost and the money spent, and everything with weapons of mass destruction, Iraq, and everything that unfolded. I just want to see if, you know, they feel as conflicted as I do about the whole thing and warfare and patriotism and, you know, all of that tied together. I don't know, just their thoughts on that.
Feeling conflicted. And Joshua, if I could ask you, when were you in Iraq?
I did two tours. First was 05 through 06. The second one was part of 06 into 07.
Wow, and 06, from what I understand, was one of the worst times there.
Yeah, that's when Fallujah got cleaned up.
Yeah, and so if I were to ask you, how are you feeling a decade later, sounds like you'd say conflicted.
I'm just conflicted about the way this nation, you know, wages wars, and I don't know if you want to call it propaganda, but I've been looking into who benefited from the war, because it wasn't your average citizen and it wasn't your average soldier or Marine.
Okay.
So why did we do it?
Joshua, thank you very much for calling. And Al Porsche, I'm actually going to turn to you first. Joshua asked about parallels between Vietnam, where you served, and where he served in Iraq, and feeling conflicted, as he said.
Right. That's a common dilemma that the returning soldier faces with the nature of warfare that we often experience at this point in time in our history, and starting with the Vietnam War. I'd like to first thank Joshua for his service and his sacrifice. It's true that, you know, there's quite a bit of controversy whether the war in Iraq was a war of choice or a war of necessity, the Vietnam War, the Gulf of Tonkin. Did that happen? Was that reason to start the war? Was it more a play of Cold War, surrogate war between the United States and communist Russia and China? But the dilemma that the soldier faces is the soldier doesn't get to make these decisions. Our political leaders make these decisions. The soldier has his duty and is serving his country, believes that his elected leaders are responsible and not asking them to make that sacrifice when it shouldn't be justified. And so it's quite the challenge when they come home to sort of maintain at the same time in their head a great pride in their service and their sacrifice, and at the same time realize that perhaps it was not necessary, or it was our leaders asked us to do that when perhaps there could have been a diplomatic approach or some other approach that wouldn't have led to having to experience all that one experiences when one goes to war. So that is a great challenge. Max Cleland, a triple amputee from Vietnam, has a great quote. He says, "Wars are not over when the shooting stops. They live on in the lives of those who fight them. That is the curse of the soldier he or she never forgets." And the reason I like shows like this is I would add that, no, the soldier never forgets, but neither should the rest of us.
Yeah, and Jacob Worrell, before he left us, was kind of saying, you know, 10th anniversary maybe for the rest of the nation, but for him, it's something he's thinking about every day. How do you sort through this, Oliver, feeling conflicted, you know, proud of your own service and the role you played, but conflicted about the war overall?
Well, let me just say thank you, Joshua. Hoorah and Semper Fi. I will tell you that his battalions, 1-2 and 2-6 in Fallujah, saw some of the hardest fighting ever.
Wow.
Every day you left that base or wherever it was, whatever command outpost, whatever patrol base, the likelihood that you were going to get hit by an ID or an ambush, you had about almost an 8 out of 10 chance of doing that. And that was for everybody, regardless whether you're going to combat patrol or just a convoy. So that weighs on you mentally, psychologically. I was initially sat in the operations center giving the general officers their intel, their intelligence briefs, their intelligence summaries. And that wore on me a lot, because after day after day after day, watching and hearing about guys dying, and particularly friends of mine, and I have several of them that died, I couldn't deal with it anymore. So I ended up going out on foot patrols. I would go out. I would gather stuff. I was working some special programs out there that were fantastic. There was no – I wasn't out there to win the hearts and minds, I can tell you that. But you had to get out there and you had to share that. And it develops a brotherhood that, you know, sports teams, being on a sports team can come close to it, but nothing even like that. So as Max Cleveland says, that is a very good quote because you really do live with it for the rest of your life, particularly when you think about how did you make it through that particularly difficult time you lived while these other guys died. That is, you wrestle with that every single day, and it makes you, it should make you think, you know, you're pretty lucky, but sometimes you don't feel so lucky.
Well, I can imagine, yeah. And getting to Joshua's point again, and Joshua, thank you for calling in again. He talked about parallels between Vietnam and Iraq, feeling conflicted. I wonder what you think, Al, though. Did we learn one thing from Vietnam where we can celebrate the soldier but not necessarily the war? I wonder what you think about that.
I think that's true. I think it has been helpful that the society realizes that it's very important to welcome the soldier home after they have answered the call of duty for their country. But I would also add it's a mixed blessing because in some ways the soldier doesn't know quite how to feel because of the contrast between the mythical view of war, which the society at large holds that it's heroic, it's glorious, and the good guys wear white hats and the bad guys wear bad hats. And the soldier experiences the sensory experience of war, where, you know, fear brings us all back down to earth. And when they return home, they view the society from a long way off, because here the people still believe the mythology of it. And the soldiers had to experience, of course, the horrible things that take place in war, the actual lining people up between the sights and your rifle and killing them. And as Oliver mentioned, that's what creates the incredible bond between soldiers, because the combatants live for their fellow soldiers.
There's
a world outside the unit, and that's what really helps them maintain. So it's a mixed blessing. It's good that people are supporting people and thanking them for their service, but at the same time, the soldier has to deal with the fact that they feel like they've crossed these moral transgressions and have to live with the consequences of that.
Well, and in a minute, Al, I want to pick up on what you just said. No white hats, no black hats in this war, but just how difficult it was to really know who and what you were fighting. But I also want to invite our listeners again to join us at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page if you'd like. Today in the exchange, we're getting the reflections of Granite State veterans on the 10th anniversary of the Iraq War. And let's go next to Nashua. Tom's been waiting there. Hi, Tom. Thanks for calling in. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
Yes, well, my reflection on it is I have been around the military and intelligence communities for a long time. I started working back with Nixon, was president, and Carter, and have still been in that industry. So I've seen a lot of different actions and reactions. And I very clearly remember the day that you played the tape earlier with when Bush announced that we were doing this. And
right.
One of those seminal moments that you just burns into your brain this is a significant event. And I just prayed that they had some really important intelligence behind this, because it could be a serious problem otherwise. And I think things have shown that it really wasn't a good action overall to have done this. So I have two sons who, like some of your the people you've been talking with, heard all these events. They were in high school at the time. They both enlisted to do their service. One deployed to Iraq with the big surge there, and very proud of both of them. One trained for a number of years to deal with weapons of mass destruction. He ended up not deploying because they decided that there were no massive weapons of mass destruction after all, but my two sons have been in there. And
so your other son served over there?
Yes, yeah. He was over there, and he, as one of the other speaker said that he got hit by several IEDs. Thankfully, was not. I mean, he has stress from that, but didn't get.
He made it back, yeah.
He made it back.
So what's he thinking about now, Tom, given it's been a decade? I mean, it seems unbelievable. What's kind of going through his mind?
Well, he's trying to get it, as you've been discussing, he's getting his life back on track. And he's back, had to find a job and get his life started over again. So I think he's very proud of what he did. And but it does leave, it's not the... you sort of lose track of, well, why were we there? Because Osama bin Laden wasn't in Iraq. He was over in Afghanistan. So,
Tom, many thoughts from your call, and thank you so much for joining us. And I guess I'll pick up first with what he said, Oliver, to you and to Al. The last thing that Tom said, I asked about his son. He said, well, he's proud of what he did. He's trying to get his life back on track. How hard is it to come back from these experiences that you had in Iraq and Afghanistan and quote unquote, get your life back on track?
Well, I had made several deployments prior to that. I'd done Somalia. I had been in Desert Shield, Desert Storm. I had been down in South America. I had been in Bangladesh doing humanitarian. And you come back from those deployments, and the thing that's very surreal is you go into a supermarket and you see all this food, and you see all the, and it's just very surreal. Coming back from Iraq, certainly my first time, you come back, particularly after you've been to so many memorial services, and frankly, at that time, you saw a lot of yellow banners around trees and on people's things, but you just didn't see people really engaged with it. You got a lot of thank yous, and you always appreciated it. But folks really had sort of a fingernail deep knowledge of what was going on. And that's a little frustrating when you're out there. And particularly for me, I was so deep into the intelligence part. So I had I was privy to so much of what was going on, mostly in Al-Anbar province. So that sort of wears thin, and people want to have a conversation. It's sort of like, I call it a cocktail party conversation, and you really want to engage them with the real truth and have them really sit down. And at any given time, I was ready to sit down and give a PhD level discussion on what really was going on. And you sort of get frustrated when people just they lose their patience or they lose their interest in the real truth of it.
Their eyes glaze over, and you kind of lost them. And when you said fingernail deep understanding and appreciation, that gets to something else that we've heard a lot about recently with the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. And Al Porcia, for you, it's the idea that we don't have a draft. It's an all-volunteer army. And military people have talked a lot lately about this disconnect between the regular public, the rest of us, and the military. I wonder how that wears on the veterans that you work with, Al, just picking up on what Oliver said.
Right. I think it makes it much more difficult because they do feel that even though we talked about welcoming people home, the yellow ribbons, what have you, our president told people to go out and shop after 9/11. We didn't raise taxes to pay for these wars. So the American public was pretty much immune from the day-to-day knowledge of what was going on in the war. It would be a news story and they'd turn the page and see how the Boston Bruins were doing. And so I think that's very frustrating for the veterans when they come home. And I think that has a lot to do with their tendency to some of the symptoms of PTSD, which include avoidance and the isolation, because they just don't feel comfortable around people that don't really want to, as Oliver was saying, they really don't want you to go into depth. I know there's been some fiction written recently, Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk, a great book by a guy named Ben Fountain, who talks about a squad they bring home from a tour in Iraq for a promotional tour, and it culminates on a Dallas football game and all these high rollers going up and saying, how are we doing over there, son? But not really wanting to know any of the details of the war at all.
Mm.
And so I think that is a problem. And, of course, because of the symptoms that at least 20% of our veterans coming back from of post-traumatic stress make it hard for the veteran to connect with people in any event. The increased hyper-arousal, the irritability, the angry outbursts, they're not sleeping well, just having trouble feeling comfortable around people, hyper-arousal. It's, I think Jonathan Shea, who was on your show a few years ago, said it best. It's the combination of the persistence of combat adaptations into civilian life, so things that were strengths of in a war zone now distance you from people back home, and then that destruction of social trust, sort of a loss of faith in the inherent goodness of most people. And that's the real challenge that at the Vet Center and at the VA Medical Center that we really have to work to try to help people walk their way back from that and build a sense of community again.
Well, and picking up on something you said earlier, Al, and this is what our caller also mentioned, no white hats, no black hats, hard to know who was who. Both of you mentioned IED, improvised explosive devices. There was an aspect to this war, Oliver, right? Correct me if I'm wrong, where it wasn't like, you know, fighting the Nazis. Sometimes, right. I'm guessing you really didn't know who was who.
Yeah, and it's the whole, the IED, if you were to have a poll, is probably going to be come down as the greatest weapon system of the 21st century.
Very simple.
Very simple, low cost. You know, AK-47 was probably the greatest weapon system of the 20th century. IED, 21st century. But it does take away that face-to-face look and that engagement. And if you talk to your veterans, particularly now in Afghanistan, where they're really – it's gone to a whole other level. There are weeks, just like in Vietnam, where troops will not see the enemy. But they know the enemy's out there because they're getting hit by these IEDs. I got hit by twice in Iraq by it. Luckily, due to the countermeasures we had, I walked away pretty much fine. But it really is on your psyche. It is devastating. The efforts involved to defeat them are incredible. But at the end of the day, you can throw as much money at this stuff and as much technology. And this is a very low-tech, again, the greatest weapon system of the 21st century.
Yeah. Well, we did a whole program a couple weeks ago on asymmetric warfare. And this is what came up, Oliver, is, you know, cheap, easy, and yet devastating to even the greatest military power on the planet. Here's an email that I just want to share with you, gentlemen. I don't think I need a response, but this is Jim in Stratford. He says, the former UN Deputy Secretary General Brian Urquhart described the results of the Iraq War as follows. The position of the U.S. in the world was dramatically weakened. The unique respect and the authority as a world leader that the U.S. had enjoyed were severely compromised. The U.S. military establishment was overstretched without achieving any strategic advantage. Jim says, I agree, but I respect the vets for their service and understand why they would want to see the worth of their service, because the veterans' service was exemplary, perhaps the only good part of the war. So, Jim, thanks for that email. And we'll take more of your calls and emails after a short break. The number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Stay with us.
This is NHPR, where support comes from UR members and Massachusetts General Hospital cancer specialists. Now at the Center for Cancer Care in Exeter, exeterhospital.com/cancer. And University of New Hampshire School of Law and its Franklin Pierce Center for Intellectual Property, pioneering legal education for New Hampshire and the world at law.unh.edu. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
Today on Word of Mouth, the invisible gun debate. Advances in 3D printing could soon lead to on-demand weapons being produced at home. So why are lawmakers all but ignoring the issue? And Lady Lamb the Beekeeper talks about growing up in New England and plays some music. I'm Virginia Prescott. Word of Mouth catches a rising star today at noon and again at 9 on NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, the debate over Medicaid expansion in the Granite State. Email us your questions and comments before the program at nhpr.org and join us tomorrow morning live at 9. Today in The Exchange, Granite State veterans reflect on the 10th anniversary of the Iraq War. And let's hear from you if you have personal experience with this war. Either you served yourself or a member of your family or close friends served. Tell us what's going through your mind as people around the country reflect back on this day. as the war started a decade ago. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. We go now, gentlemen, to Major Greg Heilshorn. He's Public Affairs Officer for the New Hampshire National Guard. And Major Heilshorn, thank you for being with us. We appreciate it.
My pleasure, Laura. Good morning.
Well, lots of stories over the 8 years of the Iraq War about major New Hampshire Guard deployments going over there. What was the role of the New Hampshire National Guard in Iraq, Major Heilshorn?
We had a whole host of different roles, everything from combat missions to combat support. We had mountain infantry company over there. We had 2.5 battalions worth of field artillerymen serving over there as military police. We had engineers over there. And 24/7 down at Pease, our airmen were providing refueling support for the military aircraft over there as well. So this past decade is easily could be called an unprecedented time for the New Hampshire National Guard and the National Guard as a whole.
Well, and you said something, combat missions. Now, the impression I think the general public has, Major Heilshorn, is that National Guard doesn't do combat.
They do. We are trained just like our active duty brothers and sisters for all those different missions. So we're trained to the same standard.
And obviously, war is challenging for everybody. But I wonder, Major Heilshorn, are there particular challenges that National Guard forces face?
I think one of the biggest challenges is for guardsmen coming home. Unlike active duty folks, there's not one central base or location they and their families can go to and sort of get all the support that's necessary, for that transition back into civilian life. When you're a guardsman, you literally are going back into your communities, your jobs, and we've learned a lot over the last 10 years on how to do a better job of providing the support for our men and women during that reintegration period.
Yeah, so there's not this whole sort of system that greets you when you get back, the veteran system, the bases, and so forth.
Yes, we've certainly gotten a lot better, and thanks to our congressional delegation and the folks down in D.C., they've recognized the need for the same kind of support that we give our active duty military. And the thing about New Hampshire, and I think it's happening in other states too, is a lot of our state agencies over this past decade have stepped forward and offered their services, like the Department of Health and Human Services. Even Easter Seals has a Veterans Count program that offers help for troops and their families. So really, when you send the National Guard to war, you're sending those communities as well, in a way.
Yeah, and there was a lot of coverage here about how, police departments or fire departments or corrections departments were being impacted by the guardsmen and women going over there. Just one more thought for you, Major Heilshorn. As we reflect on this 10-year anniversary, what are the Guard members that you work with thinking about? What's going through their minds today?
Well, I don't know if it's as big a deal for the guys and gals in uniform here. For us, we're focused kind of on the present, and that means we've got two units that are either in Afghanistan or on their way to Afghanistan. We have a third unit whose their deployment ceremony is coming up at the end of April. They're headed to Afghanistan. We're still very busy down at our wing, down at Pease, providing 24/7 support for combat aircraft missions. So I think for most of us, it's another work day, to be honest.
All right. Well, Major Heilshorn, good to talk to you again. Thank you.
Thank you, Laura.
That's Major Greg Heilshorn, Public Affairs Officer for the New Hampshire National Guard. Again, the number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Al Porcia, real quickly to you. He said that unlike regular enlisted armed service men and women, the National Guard folks didn't have as much sort of basic support when they returned. I'm guessing that a lot of them came to you at the Manchester Veterans Center, though.
They absolutely did, and as a matter of fact, I'm happy to report that the New Hampshire, the Manchester Vet Center, initiated a program where we met with all the returning New Hampshire Guardsmen and many of the reservists immediately upon their return home, and had a sit-down with one of our counselors for 45 minutes to an hour to talk to them about their experiences and to let them know about the services that were available to them at the Vet Center and through the Manchester Veterans Administration, as a way of trying to plant the seed that if indeed they were having struggles in terms of their readjustment, that they would have a place to turn. And that, I think, was very helpful.
Yeah, and
some
as
of
we...
the challenges they faced are a little different than when I think of my own experiences coming back from Vietnam as a 22-year-old, unmarried, unattached, and could sort of wander around, hitchhike around the country for a while. They're coming back to intact families and jobs they're returning to, and so there's very difficult. There's no time to decompress.
Yeah, it's different, isn't it? Yeah, totally. Right. Just hearing you talk, I'm realizing what a different experience it is. And the word readjustment keeps coming up, gentlemen, so let's go there. And Oliver, you know, when I asked you about readjustment before, you talked about that feeling of disconnect from the rest of the world, so to speak. What about just day-to-day, like, you know, finding jobs, readjusting to just, like you said earlier, grocery shopping? We hear a lot about veterans being homeless, about suffering from PTSD. I mean, talk about the readjustment period to real life.
Well, anytime you go in harm's way, like so many of us did, and you lose brothers and sisters, it takes something out of you. Master of the obvious there. The issue is, how do you deal with it when you get back? And how you deal with it is depending on the support base you have back where you are. If you're on a military base, for the most part, you're in a band of brothers, and it can be a lot easier. It can also be a lot tougher because they don't want to hear anybody sniveling around. particularly for the guardsmen and the reservists who do come back to a community, it can be very devastating on that community when they lose guys, because those folks are part of that community. And I think most of these communities rally around their troops, and they do a great job of it. You've got something called the Employer Support to the Guard and Reserve up on the Heights here in Concord that does a great job, along with working with the VA and all the other vet centers to help that. But a lot of this stuff is reactive. It's a lot of reactive to, you know, what they saw as problems, and it's unfortunate that we don't sometimes learn from our mistakes when we see these guys come back. I know for myself, it was for 24 years, I never really took a breath, and I finally took a breath here this January when I retired, and it was tough because I took over the role as a stay-at-home father, and parenting some teenagers, and it has not been an easy challenge for me. And I can tell you, I'm not hardwired necessarily for this.
You mean they don't say yes, sir,
no,
when you tell them
no.
to empty the dishwasher?
Teenagers don't say aye, aye, sir, and aye, ma'am, and everything else. And so luckily I have some great friends here in the community, have been wonderful. I've had the opportunity to coach some sports around here. I do a lot of volunteer work. I help out everywhere I can. And that sort of fills a lot of the voids. Part of me doesn't miss it at all. I certainly don't miss going downrange to do some of the things I did back then. But I do miss the brotherhood, and I develop it here. And I think, as I figure out what I'm going to do in the next, you know, when I grow up in the next chapter of my life, I want to be part of something big. And I want to be part
like
of something.
Like the military.
Yeah, where you have that same brotherhood. And I think what veterans can do, particularly those who have served overseas and these things, and that's what I would, in my plug to employers out here, is there's an unknown that they don't necessarily appreciate if they've never served, and that is they will bring a sense of camaraderie, esprit de corps, leadership.
Duty.
And duty that can't be taught down at Harvard in an MBA program, cannot be taught anywhere else, that only can be learned when you're out there with your brothers and your sisters fighting and watching guys die, unfortunately.
Now, do you feel, Oliver, that employers disregard the experience and they say, well, you know, thank you for your service, Mr. Spencer, but you don't have the relevant experience for this job?
Yes, I do. I do very much so. And it's a marketing problem for me and for many of us to, and I've worked with a lot of folks and I've helped folks, and a lot of people have helped me. I have to give a lot of people here credit here in the community who help you translate your military resume into something that an employer is going to read and go, wow, I see what that means. A lot of this unnamed leadership esprit de corps does not translate to a profit and loss statement, and you've got to be able to do that for business owners, and I get that part, and I think a lot of us do. But if you've never served and you don't know what it's like to serve in a situation like that, and I go back to 2006, which just was a very tough time to serve, our operational tempo was so intense. You were working, and this is not an exaggeration, you were literally working 20 hours a day, you know, 6.5 days a week. And you got Sunday off to go to church and kind of rest and refit and do some laundry. But otherwise, you were out there doing stuff. That right there is something that I think employers here in the local area and nationwide don't truly have a great appreciation for. And so if you're going to say thank you to the vets, I think that's the best way you can thank them.
Let's take one more call if we could, gentlemen. This is Gary joining us from Manchester. Hi, Gary. Thanks for hanging on. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Morning.
Thanks for the opportunity to speak. My wife's son was in the Iraq War in 2006, which was, as he just said, one of the worst times. And I wanted to thank the people of this country for not blaming the people who served for what happened over there, whether you agree or disagree. The Vietnam veteran came back, they took it out on him or her. So I wanted to thank the people for not doing that this time around. I remember that when I was younger. I served in the Marines from 1977 to 1982. I missed everything. I didn't get in any combat. But I understand the camaraderie. Like the, I forget his name, the guy who was just on. Excellent points. I understand that. You don't get that anywhere else but in the military. And my wife's son, Jason, exhibits all the symptoms of the post-traumatic stress disorder, the distrust, the hypervigilance, the not trusting people. And he's having a hard time keeping jobs. He's been in and out of jobs. So I agree the best way you can thank a veteran is to give him a chance and give him a chance to get a job, get some dignity, and get back into life as we know it.
Well, and as we said, he was over there at the worst time then, Fallujah,
yeah,
and all that. So
yeah,
he's having a hard time finding a job and readjusting given that, huh?
He is. He is. And he's got three kids, and, you know, he does the best he can. But the survivor guilt, he's got that, which I have a hard time wrapping my mind around. You survived war. You came back with, you know, no physical injuries. And, you know, you feel bad about being alive. I don't get it, but that's what happens. It happens in every war. So I've tried to talk to him, but I don't have the same experience he does. So there's that gulf between us.
Okay.
You know?
Well, Gary, thank you so much for calling in. We really appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye now.
Al, what do you think, very quickly, if you could, the thoughts from Gary and from what we heard from Oliver, if you want to really thank a veteran, give him or her a job.
Right. Well, I think a job is important. I think for Gary, I would say that it's important that it is difficult when you're struggling with the symptoms that Gary's dealing with, and I would encourage him to consider contacting the Manchester Vets Center, because the place you can begin to rebuild community, the one community that you feel comfortable with and can trust, is other veterans. And so we not only do individual counseling there, we do a lot of groups. And so it can really help to have an opportunity to realize that you're not alone in the experiences that you're having, that other people are having similar experiences, and it's a good way to begin to rebuild that social trust and connection.
Well,
and I would just say in general, and referring back to what Oliver was talking about, people are reactive in terms of getting treatment because everyone wants to feel it's not going to be me. And then when these symptoms start to bother you, it's important to do something about it. And it's a lifetime process to chip away at some of these symptoms, some of these negative behaviors, and you may never get rid of all of them, but you keep working at it, and as Oliver mentioned, there's a lot of strengths that you can draw on, too. So that's another message we want to be sure to get out there. As traumatic and as bad as some of the experiences are of war, they're also positive experiences. So if you can work on chipping away on the negative and building on the strengths, that's certainly the best way to go about trying to, once again, establish a productive life in community and family.
Well, Gary, thanks a lot for the call. And to your point, you thanking the American public for thanking the people who served. I got an email earlier from Russ in Richmond who says, I served in 1968, 1972. No one ever, quote, thanked us for her our service. I never forgot that. So, Russ, thank you for the email. Thank you for your service, and I appreciate you chiming in on our program today. You know, Oliver, I wanted to ask you one last question. I'm guessing when you were in Iraq, you know, there's that band of brothers, so to speak, but you also get to know some Iraqis. They serve as drivers and translators and so forth. What goes through your mind when you think about those folks?
Well, I had a great experience that I did a lot of tribal engagement. I sat down with sheikhs and farmers and peasants and Iraqis about two times a week. We shared tea. I had goat. I had chicken. I had great food, great meals from these folks. And particularly, I grew up on a farm in Western Mass, and so I got to know a lot of the farmers and seeing how they did the farming. And that was really a great experience to meet some of those folks. Some of the other folks who were, you know, I call them power brokers. You always watched your six. You always concerned. You know, it was an interesting thing to meet these folks, to see a different culture and to learn a different culture.
Yeah, and I want to let everybody know that we tried to get some of the Iraqi refugees from New Hampshire to join us for this hour, because obviously this is their story too, in a huge way. They were too frightened to come on the radio with us. They were afraid that their family would face reprisals. So I want to let people know we tried to do that, but that's the dynamic. Thank you very much, Oliver, for coming on and sharing your stories with us. It's great to have you. Thank you. Oliver Spencer, former Marine who served in Somalia, Afghanistan, and Iraq. And Al Porcia, good to talk to you, too. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Laura. It's been my pleasure.
Al Porcia, Vietnam vet who worked just until recently as a readjustment counseling therapist at the Manchester Veterans Center. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our intern is Faith Meixel. Happy birthday, Faith. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy.